Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community with Dr. Adil Chimsanawala Kasim. Today we're going to be talking about, we're going to see that he is on the chat and we're just going to wait for him to sign into the show. We have been studying about the Kent repertory, the chest rubrics, one by one, what is most pertinent with stories and information that will help guide you to understand the power of homeopathy. Good day, good evening, and good morning.
Hi.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, at last.
And we have guests in the chat room, so if you have any comments, we would love to hear from you also. We're going to introduce today's show. Dr. Adil has been so gracious to spend his precious time with us. He just gave a talk and rushed out talking about obesity. Was this to a class, to students?
No, it was a general public. All Rotarians were there. And they wanted a lecture on what homeopathy could do about obesity. And I explained to them what actually is obesity, which type of obesity is harmful, what to expect, because people are crazy about losing weight. And so it was a fun lecture. Of course, I thought I would not be able to come for this lecture, for this show, but then eventually I finished up and packed up fast and came back.
We appreciate that so much. Everyone always looks forward to listening to your shows. And yes, very, very popular for the folks out there who are new to Blog Talk Radio. This is one of the top shows in the health section of Blog Talk Radio because of the powerful talks that we hear and the learning that takes place each day that we have a show together. And just to remember, this is educational, a conversation. And if you really are in need of some health wisdom, you need to listen to the shows, but then for medical assistance, see your health professional. And
exactly.
You can also go to your website, which is, tell us.
homeoacad.org.
Okay, homeoacad.org. And you can also contact Dr. Adil at his website. There is a form to fill in. Okay, so will we begin with a celebration or go into questions?
We should begin with a celebration because today is the birth anniversary of Dr. Henry C. Allen, one of the very, very leading homeopaths of his times. He was born on 2nd of October, 1830. And passed away on 22nd of Jan 1909, and basically belonging from a place called Brantford, Ontario, Canada. He studied medicine at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, completing his graduation in 1861, and then on shifted to Cleveland Homeopathic College. And as far as history goes, he served as a surgeon in the Civil War And after serving as a Civil War surgeon, he became professor of anatomy at the same college, his mother college of homeopathy, where he taught, that is Cleveland Homeopathic Medical College, and later at the Hahnemann College in Chicago. In the homeopathic department of the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, he was the professor of Materia Medica and clinical medicine for 5 years, that is from 1880 to 1885. Thereon, he became the first dean and the president of the governing board of the Herring Medical College in Chicago, and continued his teaching as the professor of Materia Medica, and wrote a wonderful basic book in homeopathy, which throughout the homeopathic world we use it, and that is called Keynotes to the Leading Remedies of the Materia Medica. Also, he was the author of Therapeutics of Intermittent Fever, a wonderful book, a small book, but I really like it. I mean, you just go through it and you can solve fever cases at the tip of the tongue. And then he also wrote the Materia Medica of the Nosodes, but this book came after, was published after his death, that is in 1910 it was published. He was also the founder of IHA. So, such a great personality we had, and wonderful that he contributed to homeopathy. I pay my deepest respects and homage, and we remember him today. That is 3rd October, 2nd October he was born. We remembered him today. So my homage to this great personality.
And the International Hahnemannian Association had this to say about him in memoriam. Quote, he was one who truly gave, not only of his love and sympathy, but of his time and effort and money to all who needed his aid. No one will ever know how many poor and suffering he helped, nor how many needy, struggling young students and physicians he aided with advice and money and encouragement. To the young and especially women in the profession, he was a tower of strength. Unquote. And so we can see that we give as much as we can, and when somebody asks even for a donation, it sounds like he gave. I know that many people, many of the students come to my husband, who is a professor at NC State, and he gives them lunch money quite often because
wow.
They are, yes, because they are struggling students, and they do need help in rough times, rough economic economy. So it sounds like this is what he did, and it's very interesting that he was working in the Revolutionary War under Ulysses S. Grant, and I wonder, he was served as the surgeon under General Ulysses S. Grant. I wonder if he gave him remedies. Would it be interesting to learn?
Actually, he should have. I mean, there were no records, but the keynotes to the Leading Remedies of Materia Medica he collected. Therein he has mentioned quite many statements and all, wherein shows that he has great amount of experience of certain drugs. For example, I would like to mention here about diphthyrinum. In the chapter diphthyrinum in Allen's keynotes, we call it Allen's keynotes. We don't call it the keynotes to the Leading Remedies of Materia Medica. It's a big name. So Allen's keynotes is a very basic book. And in the chapter of diphthyrinum, on the last page, he says that you give this remedy to the person. And I quote, he says, I have never known a second case of diphtheria to occur in the family after giving this nosod, that is diphthyrinum. And I exhort the medical fraternity to publish the failures to the world. He did not say successes to the world. He said, publish the failures to the world. That means he was so confident of this remedy of diphthyrinum acting and preventing diphtheria. So that means to say that he should have been giving it to a large number of patients, and large number of patients are available in times of wars. So like these, many of such statements have been made by him in a small book, that is Allen's keynotes.
Wonderful. So he is a stalwart who we always look back on and read his works to confirm the Materia Medica.
Exactly.
And yes,
such a basic book. I remember when I wanted to see, I came from modern medicine. I wanted to enter homeopathy. So one of the basic books, I asked my father, which was the first, which is the first book I should read? And he gave me this Alinsky Notes. He said, master this book. Unless and until you master this book, you will not be able to understand homeopathy at all. So I started reading. I thought it was such a small booklet. I mean, having read volumes of medicines, books of medicines, this small book was, I mean, not a big book for me. So I started reading. But I did not like the book initially. Because,
oh, really?
having read Borik, Borik is given, Borik's Metabolica is so, systematic. And we are used to reading systematic things, like head, and then neck, and then throat, and then this and that. So I used to like Borik very, because such a systematic book, and Metabolica is given so. And as far as Alan's keynotes is concerned, everything is given. I mean, you start with the head, and suddenly you have a mind symptom, and then suddenly you have a symptom of female genitalia. I said, I can't understand. Why does this author keep on fleeting his ideas? And the only thing my dad told me, you have to study homeopathy according to its own laws and its own writings. Homeopathy can't change for you. You have to change for homeopathy. Only then can you learn homeopathy. If you learn the language of this author, you may be able to practice homeopathy in future. So those words are really inscribed in mind. And then I began to learn what Henry Allen wanted to say. And it's a masterpiece. Every single chapter, you keep on reading, and every time you find something new.
And you know what's really funny? I have sitting out on my desk today and yesterday this yellow book. It's a beautiful book, Allen's Keynotes, Open to Aconite, because I always refer to it for the major symptoms, and he knows his remedies so well that he can picture them and tell us exactly what it is for. And
exactly.
Yes. So he is my companion on my desk.
He is a companion of every practicing homeopath, I believe, because it's a master book, such a small book, but a wealth of information, gems which come in single sentences, but they explain diseases fully. So, I mean, I exhort at least all homeopaths who really want to practice homeopathy or want to start homeopathy, they should read this book and remember it throughout their life and then proceed on to other books like Borik's Metabolica or Ken's Philosophy and Ken's Metabolica, wherein the in-depth description of particular drugs are given. But then this is the starting book, and it really becomes a clinical book for clinicians to practice homeopathy.
Okay. Well, we do have some listeners in the chat, and I'm sure they're all waiting to find out what we're going to talk about today.
Yep. Before I go on to the subject proper, and that is discussion of our rubrics, there is a question by one of my students, Dr. Chaitanya from Hyderabad. Hyderabad is a place in central India, and he says, sir, what is the difference between sensitivity and susceptibility? A very good question. I mean, we take those two, words. I mean, often left, right, and center, we keep on repeating these words. But then we need to know the difference between sensitivity and susceptibility. Well, Chaitanya, sensitivity and susceptibility are two fundamental attributes of a living organism. Any living organism would have these two attributes. So without considering these attributes in depth, it is difficult to fathom the problem of potency selection. Both sensitivity and susceptibility are specifically used in homeopathy for potency selection.
Yeah? Sensitivity and what's the second
susceptibility.
Word?
Susceptibility.
Okay, good. Susceptibility.
Yeah. We actually equate them very often, but then they are two different attributes. They are two fundamental attributes of a living organism. Sensitivity denotes the reactivity of an organism to sensory inputs. It is the capacity of a living organism to feel and respond to any stimuli. Now, without this, the organism will not be able to cope up and survive in this universe. An example of sensitivity is a case of allergic diathesis, wherein a person is hypersensitive to various stimuli. Sensitivity has to be judged both at the level of mind and body. So this is sensitivity. Whereas when we talk about susceptibility, susceptibility denotes the capacity of an individual to react to any form of stimuli. Sensitivity is reactivity to sensory inputs, whereas susceptibility is the capacity of an individual to react to any form of stimulus, and it is due to this that an individual casts out variable expressions. I remember Dr. Stuart Close. He says that the more similar the remedy, I repeat, the more similar the remedy, the more clearly and positively the symptoms of the patient take on, peculiarly and characteristically the potency is required. So, both of them on the outset appear similar. Susceptibility is a greater fundamental quality, and from susceptibility, a person or an individual or an organism develops sensitivity. Sensitivity is to a particular thing. Susceptibility is in general. Susceptibility and sensitivity. I believe I could have conveyed the difference between sensitivity and susceptibility.
It's a very fine line. So just let me see if I understand what you're explaining. Sensitivity is maybe the level of reactivity of an individual or a living organism to react to something specific in the environment. And then the susceptibility is the capacity form a sensitivity to a stimulus.
Okay. Susceptibility forms the base of sensitivity.
Okay. So if someone is not susceptible to a specific form of stimuli, then they won't respond or react.
Exactly. And they would not be sensitive either.
Okay. And somebody who is hypersensitive reacts to many things in their environment or overreacts to specific things in their environment.
Yeah, totally, I agree.
Okay, I'm just trying to make myself understand what it is that you're saying. And we have some people in the chat. This one person, LiveFeed USA, says said when a person gets sick and needs antibiotics, the doctor also prescribes vitamin C and vitamin B along with other homeopathic remedies, along with probiotic regimen after the dose of antibiotics were done. I don't know if it's a question or a comment, and she, whoever it is, has written a number of items.
Well, let us probe. I mean, let us clarify this or amplify this question.
He or she, whoever is there, she wants to say that along with antibiotics, people prescribe vitamins. Fine. So antibiotics is for the specific bacteria in question, and vitamins are basically to increase the resistance power. That is opposite of susceptibility. Susceptibility and resistance. So it is quite similar to a question what she wants to say. Susceptibility and resistance are two ends of the same coin. I mean, one is resistance, greater resistance, lesser the susceptibility. Greater the susceptibility, lesser the resistance. So, yes, vitamins are given in the hope to increase the resistance power of the individual, the fighting capacity, whereas the antibiotic per se is given only to tackle that particular bacteria or the group of bacteria which is in question.
Okay.
The second question is also quite interesting, and it is from a person called Dr. Delmade from Nanded, again a place, a very small place in Maharashtra where we live. He says, after passing BHMS, now BHMS is Bachelor of Homeopathic Medicine and Surgery, it's a course, it's a degree course in homeopathy in India. So after passing BHMS, I used to work under a senior homeopath for some time. He had his favorite remedies for various diseases. What is your view regarding this approach of practice? Favoritism of remedies. Dr. Delmade, the success with a particular medicine in a particular type of disease almost invariably leads the physician to consider the medicine as a specific one. For example, if I get a very particular, very good result of chest pain being tackled with cactus, then if I am a prejudiced physician, I would always prefer cactus as a first choice for any sort of chest pain, since I have healed one case with that particular remedy. So therein I tend to overlook the other great amount of remedies which are there for that particular rubric or for that particular symptom. Now, this administration of favorite medicine often results in neglect of other remedies, which could have been more useful in another fresh case. For this, Dr. Hanneman has advised the physician to investigate each new case as a fresh case without any prejudice, because the moment you have got favorite remedies, you are prejudiced. And the moment you are prejudiced, you are actually breaking the laws of homeopathy. You are not going according to the laws of homeopathy, however good of homeopath you may be. Totality of symptoms should be determined in each case, and the patient should be individualized. This is the essence of homeopathy. If you defeat this, the entire purpose of homeopathy is defeated. See, homeopathy is not only giving medicine. Homeopathy is basically a philosophy to be followed. And the philosophy is individualization. We bounce upon individualization, not only individualization of the entire case, individualization of the entire symptom, the completeness of the symptom, the modalities, the concomitants, everything makes a particular symptom to be individualized. So if you don't follow this, then the entire purpose of case taking and practicing homeopathy is defeated. A true physician will always avoid and making use of his favorite remedies, because once, twice, it may lead to success, but in many cases, in the long run, it leads to failure and it leads to dejection. The medicine can never be accurate if it is selected with a prejudiced mind by the physician. So at least as a budding homeopath, if you are starting homeopathic practice, if you have experienced this type of fallacy in your previous years, please don't repeat them, or you don't follow them. You follow what Hanneman has said, and that is individualization. There is nothing as favorite remedies. Remedy is for the patient, and the patient is the entire case. Take the case, take the symptoms in a scenario, prescribe, and you will be successful.
Wonderful. Do you have more questions from...
I do have more questions, but I think we should also do our homework
study?
About rubrics.
Okay.
So we come to the chest chapter, page number 829, Kent's Repertory.
Page 829.
And we had finished discharge from nipple, and we are about to start discoloration, blueness, clavicle near, copper color, livid, etc.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
So, now, discoloration, blueness, clavicle near, it is, that is called peripheral cyanosis. It happens in peripheral cyanosis. For example, if the artery near the clavicle, the subclavian artery, is blocked or clogged, then you may have mild blueness. And the drugs are arsenic and cupromet. What, there's one thing very interesting here. Discoloration coppery. The only drug given is stramonium.
Right, stramonium.
Yeah?
Now, yes.
There is another rubric on the next page, page number 831. We have got eruptions coppery. Eruptions, red, and below red is coppery. You have got Merksol and stramonium again. Next page, page 831.
Yes.
Now, these two are quite different. Eruptions coppery and discoloration coppery. Now, let us understand in which disease discoloration coppery occurs. Because stramonium, although it is given in one mark, forms a very, very important remedy for this condition. And discoloration coppery occurs in a disease which is called as hemochromatosis, or in vernacular language we call it bronze diabetes mellitus. Hemo means related to iron, chrome means color, so hemochromatosis or bronze diabetes. This is an inherited disorder, and it causes iron overload. It's iron type 1 diabetes mellitus, a very bad diabetes. Type 1 diabetes mellitus and iron overload. So when iron is overloaded in the body, initially in the liver and then in the blood, and then it shows on the skin in the form of bronze or coppery colored discoloration of the skin. And when this starts, you also have starting of joint pains, you have got thyroid problems, generally hypothyroidism, or sometimes hyperthyroidism. You have got hair loss, and the hair loss is generalized. So that's alopecia areata. Sorry, alopecia universalis. You don't have areata. Areata means only particular area. So you don't have patchy alopecia. You have generalized alopecia. You can have hair loss from the scalp, then your beard in a male, pubic hairs, armpit hairs. All hairs start falling. And in females, you have got low menstruation. The flow is very, very less, very scanty menstruation. Many females on the day of their periods would only have got typical abdominal pain, one or two drops of blood, and it goes away. Very scanty menstruation. In men, a very remarkable feature is importance, recurrent abdominal colics, and rarely these people shift on to pancreatic malignancies or pancreatic cancer. So discoloration, coppery, is hemochromatosis or bronze diabetes. Since it's an inherited disease, it has got no treatment, but with drugs like stramonium, we can have a great amount of relief from diabetes. Because since it's type 1 diabetes, you have to give outside external insulin. But with stramonium, of course, in this case, stramonium has to be given for a longer period of time and in very, very minimal potency. Say, we start with 1x or 2x. And we need to give time. I've seen only a single case of hemochromatosis. It's very, very rare out here in India. So I've seen only one case, and that too not followed with homeopathy. So I don't have personal experience of it. But I've read cases of hemochromatosis being not solved, but being taken care of with senior homeopaths in India. And I remember reading in one of the journals, and he has given this stramonium because he had the only drug to be given. And for quite a long period of time, the patient was managed fairly well, and the insulin doses were curtailed to a particular level. Because as time progresses, the insulin level keeps on, the insulin demand of the body keeps on increasing, and it's a headache for the patient. Excess insulin and greater the amount of insulin, you have got greater abdominal colics. So it's a terrible disease, hemochromatosis, iron overload, bronze diabetes.
Okay. So are we going back to 829?
Yeah. So we were talking about 829 page discoloration,
yes.
Because this was something which I believe many people would not have known. Otherwise, all of the rubrics are self-explanatory. Discoloration, redness, whenever you have got inflammation, the area becomes red, and you can have varied diseases depending upon which area of chest has become red. Then we have got discoloration in spots. Now, black or mottled spots, it is also called as purpura. Black spots or mottled spots. Spots, black, mottled, the drug is Vipera. I would also add Bothrops and Elaps. Again, two remedies from the snake kingdom, snake family. Vipera is given, but we have also seen in provings of Elaps, which is another remedy, and also in the proving of Bothrops, they've got black mottled spots. Many times in patients of septicemia, you can develop this black mottled spots, which are really black. Otherwise, they are blackish blue in color or blackish purple in color, which are called as purpura. Now, purpura can be idiopathic. That means the cause cannot be known. It's a bad disease because the platelet count is less, and the only remedy there in modern medicine is in times of crisis, you have to give artificial platelets, external platelets, or in routine times, you have to give steroids. But I am so very thankful to homeopathy. We have at least 25 to 30 cases of idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, ITP, who are doing very well, and we have been having them since years together, off steroids since past so many years. And few of them started as children. We have had three or four cases who came to us at the age of 5 to 6 years, and now they are 15, 16 years free of disease. Many have undergone pregnancies, uneventful pregnancies. So, but we follow constitutional therapy. We have not given drugs like Vipera only in certain cases wherein the platelet count has to increase, I mean, it's dropped too low. The critical platelet count which a patient can survive is 48,000. Below 48,000, the normal platelet count is above 1.5 lakhs. But if it goes below 48,000, then it is a crisis phase for the patient. And when the platelet count decreases in, say, diseases like dengue, it's a mosquito-driven disease, dengue, very, very common in India. We keep on having epidemics, and wherein the platelet counts go down so low, we have got 3 to 4 days of fever, and then you have got a hemorrhagic type of dengue wherein the patient spits out blood or passes blood in the urine. The platelet count is less and it's a time of crisis. In such cases, if the platelet count is not even coming by steroids, you have to resort to drugs like Viperra or Bothrop or Elaps. And we have seen remarkable results in such a case. So when we, since we are talking about spots, black mottled, I was also saying about purpura or idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura. Thrombo means blood. Cytopenic means the thrombus, platelets are less. Penia means less. So thrombocytopenic purpura. Purpura is a result of platelets becoming less.
Two other snake remedies listed under the spots is the crotalus.
Crotalus, another wonderful remedy. Yeah.
Both of them are listed there. And in the chat room, one of the people says that they don't consider diabetes to be a quote-unquote disease, but consider it to be a disorder because of probably diet and behavior. Do you think that it is?
No, what the diabetes which I was talking about, that was along with hemochromatosis. Hemochromatosis. What happens is in hemochromatosis, the iron is overloaded. I mean, the liver and the pancreas and surrounding organs, glands, are overloaded with iron. So the insulin secreting cells are not able to function. That is why diabetes develops. It is quite different from the diabetes, what we are talking about, diabetes mellitus type 2, which is a state. I mean, it's a totally different disease. Here, a diabetic disease or diabetic state is produced because of iron overload. It's an inherited disease, hemochromatosis. So this diabetes is different. It's not same as what the audience is speaking about.
Okay.
Okay.
So yes, thank you.
So we have got discoloration, spots, black and mottled, and then we have got the discoloration, brown, and in that brown we have got liver.
Okay, so we have brown with a number of remedies and itching.
Only one remedy, lycopodium is given.
Am I looking
brown
at spots? Brown spots.
And in that, we have got itching, on mammy, dark, ecchymosis, freckles, liver.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. Liver says lycopodium.
Yep.
Okay.
And below that is yellow. As yellow spots also indicate jaundice. Jaundice is not always complete discoloration of the skin, that is a yellowish discoloration of the skin, yes, but it also comes in spots, and that's the difference between lycopodium and phosphorus. When phosphorus has to be indicated, the jaundice is spotty. It generally occurs when we have got jaundice because of gallstones. If you've got gallstones and that causes jaundice, it causes excessive itching in the evening along with spotty discoloration. That means discoloration for the entire skin is not yellow, but the yellowness comes in spots. So that's the difference between phosphorus and lycopodium. Lycopodium is jaundice, it is called icteric tinge, I-C-T-E-R-I-C, icteris.
Okay.
And if the liver is failing, in the last stages of liver cell failure, you have got this brown spots, which are called liver spots also. And it's a bad omen. I mean, once that comes, you know that the patient is going to go fast. And that is also occurs in proving of lycopodium. So liver cell failure, liver cirrhosis of liver, in that you have got brown colored spots throughout the body, particularly localized in the trunk, that is the chest and the abdomen.
And these just show up very quickly in the body? Is the body's way of giving a sign?
It's actually a signal. It's a signal that the liver cell is... why it is produced, it's still not known. But when you see brown colored spots, you do know that the liver is at fault, or the functioning of the liver has reduced too much. Yellowness, of course, we know, all know that. But brown colored spots are also called liver spots. And it's one of the characteristics of lycopodium.
And so do we try to assist the patient? Do we give a low potency?
We have to. Yeah, we have to give a very low potency, mother tinctures, till the patient is surviving. And, not only lycopodium, but the other, taking the entire symptom scenario, whichever remedy is indicated. For example, very frequently, remedies like China or Chelidonium, Chinopodium, they also indicated along with lycopodium. Berberis, it's a very wonderful liver remedies. Hydrastis, very, very good remedies in the end stage of liver cell dysfunction, wherein this discoloration of the spots, brown colored spots, are shown. Then we move on. Should
okay.
we?
Yeah. Yes. Well, you mentioned yellow, and yellow is arsenicum and phosphorus.
Phosphorus. And phosphorus is 2 marks. But what I wanted to impress is phosphorus, jaundice, and say, for example, lycopodium jaundice. Jaundice basically means yellow discoloration of the skin. Now, yellow discoloration can be patchy yellow discoloration, that means in patches or spots, and it can be complete, the entire skin can be completely deep yellow. Now, when you have a liver cell dysfunction, then you have a deep yellow discoloration of the entire skin. You don't have it in spots. But suppose if you have got gallstones, gallstone also produces colic. Gallstones also produces jaundice, and that jaundice is quite a patchy jaundice, and that in that case phosphorus is indicated. So that I wanted to show the difference between the icterus or jaundice of liver cell dysfunction and gallstones causing this jaundice.
Okay. Anything else there? The model you said was all of those snake remedies. And that's the end of that section.
Yeah. Before that, there is yellow itching in the evening. And the only jaundice which itches, and itches profusely, again, is because of gallstones. If you have got large gallstones which are blocking the bile duct, then you have got this type of jaundice, obstructive jaundice, which we call, or also called a surgical jaundice, wherein the patient has got great amount of itching. And there's one symptom in a drug called Dioscorea. So Dioscorea, we've got eruptions without... itching without eruptions. You don't have eruptions, and yet there's a great amount of itching. The entire body keeps on itching, and particularly the chest and the abdomen and the back. The patient actually uses a brush and keeps on brushing himself or herself to control that itching. And in, of course, although this Dioscorea is not mentioned here, but and it is generally in the evening. Why it is in the evening, we don't know. The only drug given here is sulfur. I would also add Dioscorea here and make it 3 months. Because it's a very, very specific drug wherein you have got discoloration, brown or yellowish brown, along with itching in the evening. And the cause generally here is blockage of the bile duct because of gallstones or obstructive type of jaundice. Any reason, for example, sometimes some females have got gallstone malignancy or cancer of the gallbladder. In such case, the entire bile duct is blocked, the bile keeps on collecting, you have got then liver, the bile oozes out, reverse in the liver, and then you have got this obstructive type of jaundice. It's a very bad type of jaundice because you have got a colicky pain, which is a gallstone colic, along with excessive itching and patchy jaundice throughout.
Okay, so sulfur is the one that is listed, and we're adding Dioscorea, which is yam. And would we see the person doing that physical movement of arching backward? Would that be very indicative to us to let us know?
Yeah, you can definitely see, because to relieve the pain, the patient would adopt a position most convenient to him or her. And that is why you arch backwards, because the gallstone colic is a very typical type of colic, starting from the right hypochondrium. Hypochondrium means just below the right side of the lung, and radiates to the right scapula. It's a very, very typical type of colic. And this occurs both in the malignancy of the gallbladder as well as stones blocking the or sand blocking the bile duct.
Okay. This is very prevalent today. I mean, so many people are going in for their gallbladder removed and for kidney stones and for other kinds of stones. I don't know whether it is the...
advocate, because they have got excellent remedies and innumerable cases. Now, we don't have to prove, actually. Homeopathy really removes stones. The wise and house may rest in peace. But I can give you, on this show, I wouldn't mind, and even he wouldn't mind, if I give his example. The dean of my medical college, he was not so pro-homeopathy when I used to study. And a few years ago, he had a gallstone colic. I mean, he had multiple stones in the gallbladder. And since he knew that I was practicing homeopathy, and somehow hesitatingly, he came to me and said, Adil, I would wish to try homeopathy instead of doing surgery. Although he is a surgeon himself, and he said, I don't want to undergo surgery myself, although I do perform surgery in other patients. But then, if you have got something in homeopathy, I give you 3 months. I said, sir, you can't give me 3 months. You have to take homeopathy as much as it demands. There's no time limit, 3 months or 6 months. But then let's try. And I took this case. He is basically a lycopodium, so we gave him lycopodium 1 and 1 dose. Along with it, I asked him to take Berberis mother tincture daily for, 2.5 months. And he went away. He did not report for 2 months. After 2.5 months, he came to me very happy, beaming. And he came to me with three ultrasonographies. The before one, that is full of gallbladder full of stones. And in between he did, that is about 15 to 20 days after the therapy had started. And after 1.5 to 2 months, he did again. And all he had got 8 stones. All 8 were cleared.
Mm-hmm.
And he started explaining, asking, I never knew homeopathy could act. Why didn't you tell me, sir? I said, instead of telling you, I have already showed the result. I don't need to speak anything. And since then, he has become an ardent follower of homeopathy. Although still in medical college, he refers patients to me. And after that, he came to know that I practice homeopathy in cardiology. So specifically, he's been a great help. So I salute homeopathy, that sometimes non-believers or partial believers in homeopathy, once you give them results, especially in stones, you can actually convert them or their thinking and increase the respect for homeopathy in their minds or in their eyes.
Yes. I'm curious, though, in terms of all of these stones, that people who live in areas that have hard water with a lot of minerals, or is there something in their diet?
Yeah, we call them a stone belt. Even in India, for example, in India we have got certain areas which are very rich in stone belts. They have got fluoride in their the water is very rich in fluorine and fluoride, or very rich in calcium. So such people, 70 to 80% of the population develop some sort of stone, either gallbladder stones or renal stones. So very, very well known.
And yet people are taking so megavitamins with tons of fluoride or calcium as a supplement in there, either to the food that we're eating or to pills or capsules.
Exactly.
Or something. So is this a practice that should be eliminated?
That should be stopped. It should be stopped. There is no blanket prescription. We always have individualization. If a particular individual requires, yes, then go ahead. It should not be a blanket prescription again and again, because each individual, each organism is unique. The requirements of each body is unique. Each mind is unique. You need to respect that uniqueness. It's created by God. We are no one to give blanket. And that is the same way what I am saying of, we see of vaccination. If you require vaccination, if this body requires vaccination, yes, give it. If not, please don't impose. So same thing goes with drugs. I had last time when I had gone to Las Vegas, I believe Arizona is a very dry place, but it's also a stone belt. Someone told me there. I mean, lots of cases of gallstones and renal stones are found there. I don't know how much. And second is Texas. So these two I know for sure that many cases are there. And if people are opting for surgery, I would exhort them to first try homeopathy. If still they are not convinced with the results, then probably they should go in for surgery. Please do not let the knife touch you if the medicines can do your work.
Okay. Well, we have a lot to learn about stones because people are getting them left and right and having lots of surgeries, and then they have to do something because they had the gallstone removed, gallbladder removed, and now they don't produce the bile, and it's a long chain of events.
Not only that. Yes, I agree. Because, see, the Almighty has given everything for a particular reason. It is we humans who claim that this is not important and keep on removing since we have no other alternatives. But then there are alternatives available if we search for them. And homeopathy is a viable alternative, at least for stones, if not for anything else, I should say. And not only, see, these surgeries may look very simple. But I have been following a case of dermatomyositis. Derma means skin, myo means muscle, and itis means inflammation. Of an 8-year-old boy. And I tell you, he was a perfectly healthy 8-year-old boy, and he underwent an inguinal hernia surgery. Now, what's wrong with that? Someone would ask, what's wrong with undergoing a surgery of an inguinal hernia? I say, well, nothing is wrong, but for this boy, within 7 days of the surgery, he started developing excruciating pain on touching his entire skin as well as muscle. And he was diagnosed to have dermatomyositis. He was put on steroids, and steroids did not relieve his pain. He was bloated like a balloon. And after 7 months of discouragement and apathy, he was finally referred for homeopathic management. At that time, it was a pity to see a bright young boy reduced to a very painful situation just because of that surgery. Although his hernia was taken care of, but that hernia, that surgery, or probably the anesthetics, had initiated something which we call bad effects or ailments after surgery. We gave him one dose of staphylococcus and followed him with arnica, and it took us 8 months for withdrawal of steroids and to keep him well. Finally, his constitutional medicine was calcarea fos. We gave him calcarea fos a few doses, started with 200, 1 mg after 1 to 2 months, and now it's 4.5 years. He is completely well, free of the disease. And I tell you, dermatomyositis is an incurable disease in modern medicine. But here we have got a patient who started the entire disease scenario. No one in the family, not only his immediate family members, but in extended family, his grandparents, no one ever has heard of this disease, dermatomyositis, or similar disease like this. So, surgeries, and we have seen so many cases, they start the hypertension or diabetes, which was latent. Immediately after surgery, they start developing diabetes, which they never had. So these surgeries, we want to prevent you from these surgeries and the bad effects these surgeries can create. Of course, it is not always again a blanket rule. Whenever very, very important, whenever medicines fail, only then you can go in for surgery. But let surgery be the last resort.
Interesting. Let surgery be the last resort. Let homeopathy be the first to try.
Why not? I mean, if things can be dealt with homeopathy, give homeopathy a chance. Give homeopathy a chance. And we don't say anything no to a surgery. Everything is good, but in their own places. It should not be a general rule that for all stages of cases of gallstones, go and get operated. No.
Wow. Those are great examples for us to learn the power of homeopathy, which is a lot of what we talk about on this show. I need to look at our schedule here. We have just about 10 minutes left, and then I'm going to broadcast another show. So,
Dr. Isaac Golden was there with me at Malaysia. We had shared the same state, and wonderful speaker he is, and good advocacy of homeoprophylaxis with no swords. I really respect this gentleman.
Marvelous. Well, we'll be hearing from him soon. So,
and I finally end with one of my the last sub-rubric, that is discoloration mammy, discoloration of the breast. Interestingly, only about 3 hours ago, my dad and I were discussing. He had a case of this mammy bluish red, and we were debating. And I was very sure. I said that whenever you get a bluish discoloration of this mammy, or a blueness of ulcerated bluish discoloration of the nipple or the mammy, it generally should indicate malignancy inside. And he was saying, no, it cannot be always mammy. So we were debating. And he gave me that, why can't varicosity is like it occurs in the legs, it can occur in the breasts also. I said, but then what is the reason for those varicosities occurring? At least I believe that when we have a bluish discoloration of a mammy, you generally tend to have something, malignancy of the breast, and the general malignancy would be a Paget's disease of the breast. And yes, Lachesis is the drug of choice, one of the very, very important drugs for cancer of the mammy, which we have got. Discoloration of the nipples, we have got. Any discoloration of the nipples, one should suspect malignant change. And of course, I've never come across discoloration mammy yellow. I don't know when you have a yellowish discoloration of the mammy. I believe it's a part of the entire icteric or jaundice process, because chelidonium is the drug. But I have never come across isolated cases of mammy being discolored yellow. So I can't comment upon that.
And do they mean the entire breast itself or the nipple?
No, entire breast itself. It's given discoloration mammy yellow. So it's not. It's below the nipples. And then we've got discoloration mammy streaks. Now this indicates severe infection, generally a bacterial infection in a feeding mother who has got, a lump in the breast, or because of the child not drinking, sucking enough milk. If the sucking reflex is not good, then the blood collects and you can have a mammary abscess. And the mammary abscess shows on the mammy in the form of streaks, red colored streaks, which are very painful. And you have got all drugs like Belladonna and Phosphorus and Rustox. They are wonderful drugs for tackling the inflammation.
Okay.
So we have got this discoloration. I believe that we can end discussion. Next time we'll be starting with distension of the chest.
Okay, perfect. So if anybody wants to join in and follow along, we are using the Kent Repertory of Homeopathic Materia Medica, the chest chapter, which is page 829, is where we're located. I want to thank you again. We're in honor of Dr. Allen for his anniversary of his birthday, and people can take a look at Allen's keynotes, wonderful book. And we're going to have a regular show on Thursday with Allen Phillips talking about vaccinations and your rights in the United States. Upcoming, we're going to have a show with Kate Birch about a prophylaxis program and protocol that she is now using for children that covers between 2 and 3 years. I'm not exactly sure. I'm just going to be learning about that with her. And on Mondays at 11 a.m., we have the Health In show at 11 a.m., and I will have to check on who's going to be on the next show, but we have a whole lineup for the next month. So I'm going to say goodbye to Dr. Adil. Thank you. Have a good evening. And then I'm going to continue on with a broadcast of a talk with Dr. Isaac Golden about homeoprophylaxis.
So goodbye, Debbie. Had a wonderful time.
Thank you.
As always, the show has been great with talking to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, and folks out there, don't forget to tweet it up, put it on your Facebook, take the embed code and put the show widget onto your page, tell other people, and ask your comments, ask your questions. We're always happy to answer them and post your comments. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.
Creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member, or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go! Okay, we're moving into our second half of today's show. And I would like to let folks who are listening out there know that if they go to the homeopathyworldcommunity.com website, along the right-hand side, you're going to find a lot of little banners that take you to different areas of the website. The top one is the Miranda Castro discount code, and if you click that little image of marvelous Miranda, you're going to get to a code that you can use when you go to her website and get a 10% discount. Whether you like the balm for your lips that has all these homeopathic energy remedies in them and it's totally holistic, there's no petroleum, there's nothing that's going to harm you in there. And she has also the cell salts. So if you're looking for cell salt, she's created a brand new combination remedy with three of them for the bone health. And I know we're going to be having a special talk with her in November on the Health In Show. Then we have the Homeopathy World Kits and Remedies from Mary Aspinwall. And if you're a healthcare practitioner, if you're doing acupuncture, chiropractic, being a homeopath, or an MD who practices integrative medicine, you may want to investigate the Complete Dynamics computer program. It's the one that I really enjoy using on a day-to-day basis, and there is a link to that, so that you can have on your desktop the symptoms. You input the symptoms and you come out with the top remedies. We also have a link to Kaviraj's Organic Gardening book all about using homeopathy in your garden. And of course, Dr. Deepak Sharma is my co-host on the Health In Show. So there's a lot that you can investigate on the Homeopathy World Community. If you go down a little bit further along the website, you're going to find all of the shows that I have previously done with Dr. Christina Chambreau, veterinarian, how to take a journal of your pet health and care for them homeopathically. There's a list of all of the shows with Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim about heart health and everything else that I consider him the car talk. He'll answer any questions that you might have. And then we have Kavitha Kukunur, who is an inspirational author who traveled from India as a young mother to America, now living in Michigan and practicing homeopathy, what kind of a struggle she went through and how you can be inspired to become a homeopath in America. And of course, we have Grant Bentley and facial analysis. I just arrived home yesterday or Monday from a total workshop with him in Portland, Maine. And I did a show, an hour show with him that you can see on the Health In, concerning how the face, each of our face shows the structure of how we, our defense mechanism responds to those sensitivities and proclivities and capacity to respond to the stresses in our environment, in our emotional world, and in the toxins that we take care of every single day. Our body has a miraculous capacity to heal and to find a way to either encapsulate that disorder or to push it out, or how we withdraw in and the destructive parts of our energy. So that's also very, very informative. And he has a program to use that method of facial analysis. We're also going to now go into our special event, which is a recording that I did with Isaac Golden about homeoprophylaxis. So we're going to begin that now. If you have any comments, I'm happy to entertain them on the chat, which is still open. Hopefully this will start right away. We'll see. Okay, we're going to get some music. Welcome to the Health In Show, an affiliate program of Homeopathy World Community. And I'm your host, Debbie Bruck, the founder of the Homeopathy World Community social network. And each week, we typically have a Monday show. This is a special week with Dr. Isaac Golden calling in from Australia. And I like to thank my producer, Amnon, for being very flexible this week to enable us to have this program, and for his technical ability, getting everybody comfortable and arranging the lighting. You wouldn't believe what he does behind the scenes.
Yeah, so, and I'm going to be hurting tomorrow from all this flexible stuff.
Oh, okay, so don't forget to take your remedy each day, and you'll be fine. So we do want to thank him. And if you have any questions about your computer and making sure it is safe, spam-free, and clean, give him a call. Also, for the folks who are out there and you love the show, please give us some feedback and share it. Don't keep it to yourself. Go out there on Twitter and tweet it up. You can even do that now. Go on Facebook, put it on your fan pages, send it in your emails. Even write a blog about this show if you enjoy it. So we do appreciate your involvement. And there is a way for you to participate now via the telephone. If you live in the United States,
you can call in to 919-518-9773 or via Skype to call in to Computers2K Voice.
From
anywhere in the world. So this is really going to go global. Usually we have Dr. Deepak Sharma with us, our co-host, and because it is something like 5 a.m. in the morning, he might be half asleep. And I think I hear him calling us.
Calling.
Oh, you're calling him. Okay. So we might get a call in from there. And I'm going to give a little introduction to Dr. Golden, PhD, Doctor of Homeopathy, naturopathic physician, and founder of the Australasian College of Hanumanian Homeopathy. He did that in 1990 and is now the honorary director. Dr. Isaac Golden has been a homeopathic practitioner for 30 years and specializes in treating patients who are suffering from chronic disease using constitutional and anti-miasmatic homeopathic treatment. And for the folks who are listening out there who have never heard of homeopathy before, we might have to give a couple of definitions of things like miasmatic. In 2004, he completed a PhD research program at the GSIM, Swinburne University of Melbourne, studying homeoprophylaxis, and that's a tongue twister also for a lot of people, which is the use of homeopathic medicines for specific infectious disease prevention. This was the first time a mainstream Australian university granted a PhD for research on a homeopathic topic. And Dr. Golden is recognized as a world authority of homeoprophylaxis. There's still one more thing we're going to say. In March of 1999, he was awarded the Australian Homeopathic Association's Distinguished Service Award for his many years of service to the association and for his significant contributions to the profession in Australia. Welcome, Dr. Golden.
Thanks very much, Debbie. It's lovely to be with you, and thank you for putting yourselves out to fit in with my time schedule, because otherwise it would have been 5 o'clock in the morning over here, I think.
Right. And if I may, Dr. Sharma is calling in from India. You're here with us. Yay. Okay, so you want to say hello?
Hello, Debbie, and welcome to Dr. Isaac in the show. And it
thank
is
you,
very
Dr.
nice
Sharma.
To it is very nice to hear that Australia is beginning a PhD in the homeopathy, and we will share few things. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yes.
I would like to say that whenever we have our shows, it's purely educational, informational, and if you have a problem, a concern about your health, you need to see your healthcare practitioner. And I also like to begin with a quote of some kind. So I have this one from Dr. Robert James Graves, MD. He lived from 1796 to March 1853 and was an eminent Irish surgeon, after whom Graves' disease takes its name. He was also president of the Royal College of Physicians in Ireland and fellow of the Royal Society of London. He co-founded the Dublin Journal of Medical Science, and he said, quote, "A well-chosen anthology is a complete dispensary of medicine for the more common mental disorders and may be used as much for prevention as cure." So I'm thinking there's some kinds of potent remedies and drugs out there that can be used for prevention, and that's been Dr. Golden's investigation. I'd like to hear some words from him.
Yes. Well, look, Samuel Hahnemann, who founded homeopathy, first used homeoprophylaxis or homeopathic immunization in 1798. In fact, it might be interesting to your viewers to know that orthodox vaccination, was first used in 1796. So, in fact, the two methods, which have similar aims but which achieve the aims very, very differently, have both been around for over 200 years. And Hahnemann spoke very passionately about the importance of disease prevention. For those people who are interested to look at the original quote there, there's a book called Hahnemann's Lesser Writings, and there's an essay, The Cure and Prevention of Scarlet Fever. And in that, Hahnemann describes how he first found that homeopathic remedies could be used as preventatives as well as treatment remedies. And he spoke, as I said, very passionately about the desirability of preventing, even though we had a wonderful form of treatment, a non-toxic, safe and pretty effective form of treatment in homeopathy, he said prevention is even better. And I strongly support that statement. When you look at the history of homeopathy from the late 1700s, you'll see that the masters of homeopathy agreed with Hahnemann and also used homeoprophylaxis or homeopathic immunization, from von Bonninghausen through to Kent and right through to the modern masters, Dr. Dorothy Shepherd, many of the European homeopaths, etc. So I outline all of those in some of the books that I've written, but it's all there for people to look at. But that first reference back in 1798 is really worth reading if you're interested in this topic.
So just about the time that Dr. Graves was born, the other physicians had already done quite a bit of research and experimentation, actually getting those methods to work. And it seems like something in someone's life triggers the motivation to make that investigation. I wanted to ask you how you got started in this.
Well, originally I was I've got an honors degree in economics, and I used to do things like run a taxation practice in Canberra, Queanbeyan, and teach at university in company finance and financial accounting theory, very different to homeopathy. And I used to vaccinate my children. And many years ago, one of my children was vaccine damaged. I then started studying vaccination, and there was very little information that one could get at the time. But a little bit after that, a few years after that, I then started studying homeopathy and then became a homeopathic practitioner. And I was amazed to find Hahnemann's writings on this. And I was amazed to find that homeopathy actually offered an option to vaccination, because I'd reached the point where I'd stopped vaccinating my children but was not offering them any form of protection at all. So this really seemed like a wonderful middle way. The Buddha was very pleased. We had on one side vaccination, on the other side doing nothing at all but being concerned about certain infectious diseases, certainly not all of them, but the potentially serious ones. And homeopathy offered a lovely middle way with a method of prevention that I believe evidence shows is comparably effective to vaccination, but without any risk of toxic damage. So that's how I got started.
And what about other healing modalities or simply nutrition? That's not enough?
Well, I mean, there are always a range of options. But when it comes to preventing a targeted infectious disease, for example, meningococcal meningitis, which is potentially a very, very serious disease, then you have two options, general prevention or disease-specific prevention. So making a person as healthy as possible through good nutrition, osteopathic chiropractic care, herbal medicines, and of course constitutional homeopathic treatment will always tend to increase the level of prevention or protection against diseases, and will certainly mean that if a person acquires an infectious disease, then they will get over it more quickly. But if you want to maximize the level of prevention, you must target the disease with a disease-specific preventative. And as far as I'm aware, there's only two. One is vaccination, the other is homeoprophylaxis or homeopathic immunization. Because, you know, the real world shows us that even extremely healthy people get simple infectious diseases. So to maximize prevention about something you're really concerned about, I would do both. Always try and make the person as healthy as possible, but then target the disease that you're concerned about with something that will maximize the level of prevention.
And in our chat, we have a question from Dr. Bob, who says, when should homeoprophylaxis take place? Before an anticipated epidemic or once it starts?
That's a matter of contention among some homeopaths, so it's a very good question. Thank you for that. Some people say that Hahnemann himself only used homeoprophylaxis whilst there were epidemics present in the community. However, if you look at a country like Australia, and I would imagine that America would be similar, there are certain diseases which are always present in the community. For example, at the moment in Australia, there's a flare-up of whooping cough, and I believe in America there may be as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons for that is because the vaccine, which targets a specific antigen, because the antigen is now changing to some extent, the vaccine is losing its effectiveness. So whooping cough and certain other infectious diseases are in the community all the time. I would take the view that if you're particularly concerned about those diseases, it is quite appropriate to use homeoprophylaxis before expected exposure. You don't have to wait until an epidemic's declared or an outbreak is declared, because let's face it, for an outbreak to be declared, it means a whole lot of children needed to get sick, needed to get the disease. And the whole purpose of this is to prevent people getting the disease. So I have no problems with using it beforehand. The only consideration is whether or not using the homeoprophylaxis remedies when there is not an active outbreak will cause any long-term harm. And the second part of the study I did at Swinburne University specifically addressed that question. In other words, whether or not there was any evidence that the systematic use, the appropriate use of long-term homeoprophylaxis would in any way weaken the person who was receiving it. So what I did, I actually looked at a group of children between 4 and 14 years of age, and I looked at 5 chronic conditions, asthma, eczema, ear and hearing problems, allergies and behavioral problems, and then I looked at children who were vaccinated, children who used homeoprophylaxis, children who use constitutional prevention, which you were talking about before, as well as children whose parents did nothing at all. And I wanted to see if there was any evidence at all that children who use appropriate long-term homeoprophylaxis actually were any less well than the other children, including those who use constitutional prevention. And actually the data came back that the children using the long-term HP were slightly healthier based on those markers. And the reason we believe this is the case is because of why Hahnemann said we should do provings. In other words, the very subtle challenges to our immune system which these doses of homeoprophylaxis remedies give us actually appears to stimulate the immune system, just as getting a simple infectious disease stimulates the immune system. So the concern that I potentially had about using long-term homeoprophylaxis if there was no exposure was addressed by that research, and the evidence certainly is quite clear that it's not a problem.
Well, you've brought up a couple of questions in my mind, and one is how many children were in the different groups of the studies to make it the numbers have a lot of value to them? And that's the first question.
Yes. I did a chi-squared probability on all of the 20 different cells. Not all of them were within the 95% confidence limits, but certainly the majority were, and certainly it was clear enough from comparing the cells, how many children who were vaccinated had asthma compared to, say, how many children who used homeoprophylaxis had asthma, how many children who used constitutional prevention had asthma. So the figures were large enough to provide statistically significant results and enable meaningful comparisons to be made. And all of those have been published, by the way.
Okay. I was going to ask if they were published. I was going to ask if anybody has ever attempted to repeat that type of a study to corroborate it, and whether the traditional medical community would take value of that and take notice of these kinds of outcomes that you're showing?
That's some very interesting questions there. Taking the last one first, the answer is probably no.
No.
I mean, if no, in terms of the Orthodox medical community, unfortunately, many of whom have a completely closed mind to homeopathic medicine. And whatever data you show them, their answer will be no, because they'll say homeopathy in general, let alone homeoprophylaxis, is implausible. Therefore, whatever data is produced is unaccepted. And, I mean, unfortunately, that's just the way it is. But for open-minded and genuine scientists, of course they would be potentially interested in the data. Now, in terms of has this been repeated? Now, the interesting thing is that there was a study by Dr. Michel Odont, a French GP who now lives in England. This was back in the 1980s, published in JAMA and Lancet, I think, in the mid-1980s. He didn't look at homeoprophylaxis, but he looked at four of those five conditions, and he looked at breastfed children who were vaccinated compared to breastfed children who were not unvaccinated. And he gave a comparison just with those two groups. It was interesting for me because a subset of my work was similar to what he did. And it was interesting to me to see that I got very similar results that Dr. Odont did. I think, however, that the work that I've done incorporating the homeoprophylaxis group as well as the constitutionally protected group is unique. I'm in the process of trying to replicate that. Unfortunately, as you know, with homeopathy, there's not a lot of money available for research, and unfortunately, there's no cooperation from Orthodox health departments. So it's not easy research to replicate.
I guess you're not getting support in Australia for it. Maybe if you were in India, you would. Dr. Sharma, are there funding opportunities in India for homeopathy?
Yes, it is very good question. And India is the largest hub of the homeopathy. And there is a lot of work are doing in the homeoprophylaxis. Here we are using in the polio also. Polio is a viral disease. And we are using the poliomyelitis vaccine like a variolinum. And for the malaria, we are using the China as a prophylaxis, and it is doing well. Here is many associations are doing very good opportunity to take a homeoprophylaxis on a many disease like mumps, the balls, and chickenpox also. So, but the question... Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Sharma, I was going to say that that's really wonderful to hear, and I also heard of a very large study involving over 1 million people regarding Japanese encephalitis in one of the regions in India. My big problem is, and maybe you can help, I'd love it if you could, is that every time I've tried to contact the people who have been running these interventions to get data, I've never been able to get data. But if you could help in some way publishing or making available some of the data from those studies, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Yes, definitely. We will get in touch with the same thing. And we are, as a Delhi Homeopathic Medical Association, are using the variolinum is a medicine is very effective in the disease like chickenpox and polio. It is very effective. We are studying about more than 500 children, and there is no cases reported with the infections after the homeoprophylaxis. That is the good thing. We are just collecting data from the different association, and we will present to the WHO also.
Well, that's fantastic. I don't know if you're familiar with the massive homeoprophylaxis interventions in Cuba. I'm actually not long back from Cuba. It was my third trip there, working with the scientists, interestingly not homeopaths, but scientists at the Finlay Institute there. And in 2007 and 2008, they homeopathically immunized over 2.2 million children against leptospirosis, which is endemic in Cuba and flares up between October and December. And in 2009-10, because of the amazing success they had with those interventions, the government directed Finlay to immunize homeopathically over 9.8 million people against swine flu. So I went over there, as I said, it was my third trip over, to work with Dr. Gustavo Braccio from Finlay, who leads these interventions, and I've actually come back to Australia with a whole lot of data, and I'm working with one of the universities in Australia where they do data mining. These are mathematicians, actually, at the university, because the there's a huge amount of raw data that I've brought back, and involving, I worked it out, and it was involving over 180,000 pieces of individual data. Well, you need special techniques to get the most out of that, and they're working on that now. So if we can keep bringing really hard, good quality evidence out, eventually people in orthodox science will sit up and take notice and say, look, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. We don't know why it works. It shouldn't work according to our current theories, but it does work, and the evidence shows that. So I would love to work with you as well. If we can exchange emails and information, that would be fantastic.
Thank you. We will get in touch. Yes.
Good.
This is the beauty of the Health In Show, to have intercontinental partnerships and cooperation and innovation to think of ways that we can work together. And one day all of this data will be put together and sent to the World Health Organization and see what they will have to say once you have solid evidence. I also was thinking, you know how when you're a little kid you have a maze? And maybe there's like a mouse or something in the center of the maze, and at the end you see the piece of cheese. Well, it's almost like, Amnon's looking at me like, what is she talking about?
Where is she going with this?
Well, I'm saying that we've got the cheese. We're holding it in our hand. We have the evidence. We have the positive results, and the vaccines are the homeoprophylaxis methods are working. Now, did you ever, when you were a kid, backtrack to the center, to the mouse, to find out how to get there and not get stuck in the little blocks? That's what I'm thinking. We've got it. Now we need to just backtrack for them, or they need to be open enough to see, to look back and find the way in.
Debbie, look, sorry about this. Can I do a first for your show? I actually have to let my dog out.
Go ahead.
Who's desperately trying to get out of the room. Otherwise, I'm going to have to clean up a big mess.
Go ahead.
I'll be back in just a moment.
And we will sit and chat here. We have a couple of, we encourage you to either call in to 919-518-9773 if you're in the United States. If you are out of the United States and anywhere else in the world, or even if you are in the United States, right, you can call in with your Skype to Computer 2K Voice, and that will get you on the line. The producer, Amnon, will answer the phone, and we will listen to your question or your comment. We have a couple of things right now on the chat. Dr. Bob has written, what about childhood diseases? Would you use the same remedy for measles, mumps, chickenpox? So that would be getting into the protocol or the program. And then he says, 500 million people get malaria annually. Can this be prevented? And Ivy is in here. I don't know who Ivy is. The writings tell us to lower the susceptibility to disease, strengthen the constitution. Have you had experience with treating, Lyme disease is huge here, especially in the state of North Carolina. It's like epidemic levels. And along the East Coast, actually, this person says it's common in New England, USA, and she's asking about the remedy. So that's like 10 questions. pick and choose whichever one you like.
So look, Dr. Bob's question, with things like measles, mumps, and rubella, to be quite honest with you, in healthy children, they're very mild diseases, and they're extremely easily treated homeopathically. In malnourished children, they can be fatal diseases. So I really think that parents you know, need to think a little bit about whether they want to try and prevent everything. Because one thing that needs to be made really clear, Debbie, is that homeopathic immunization, just as with vaccines, is not 100% effective. Now, getting a particular disease in childhood is the best form of immunization in a way, but even that's not 100% effective. Some people get measles twice, some people get whooping cough twice. So we live in a world where there is always going to be a degree of uncertainty. However, I think that it is important that we don't get afraid of all disease. And so in my main program, and I've published my main program, and if Dr. Bob would like to send me an email after the show, I'd be happy to share that with him. But it's also in my books and other articles. In my main program, I actually don't cover measles, mumps, and rubella, but they are available for parents to cover if they wish. In Australia, I cover whooping cough, polio, tetanus, meningococcal disease, pneumococcal disease, and Haemophilus influenzae, HIB. Now, to me, they're the six diseases which are in the community and which are potentially very serious. So they're the ones I focus on. But as I said, if parents have a real concern about other diseases, they can add them in. Now, in terms of Lyme disease, it isn't actually anything that I've had exposure to. It's not a real issue in Australia. And so Dr. Sharma may have experience from Lyme disease in India and may be able to give better advice about that. We certainly can use the Nozode as a preventative, or we can use what's called a genus epidemicus remedy if there are certain remedies which stand out strongly as treatment remedies, but it's not an area where I have hands-on knowledge.
It would be nice for those people who are listening and have no experience with homeopathy, for them to know what is a Nozode, and also the other thing that you just said went out of my mind.
The genus epidemicus,
yes.
Yeah. Okay, so a Nozode is a remedy prepared from diseased material. So let me give you an example with the Nozode pertussis, which is the commonly used preventative for whooping cough or pertussis. So you begin with a drop of the organism. This is usually sputum from people who have clinically diagnosed whooping cough. And you mix that with 99 drops of alcohol and water and succus, which is a violent agitation of the bottle that contains the material against a firm surface. The succussion is essential. If you just dilute at each stage, the remedy won't work. Now, you take one drop of that mixture, put it with 99 drops of alcohol and water, succuss. One drop of that, 99 drops of alcohol and water, succuss, and so on. Now, people who think, oh my God, that's totally gross, I'd never give my child or myself something with whooping cough sputum from somebody else in it, according to a law of physics, Avogadro's number, by the time you've reached the 12th potency or the 12th stage of the dilution and the succussion, there are no molecules of the original substance left. The minimum potency I use in my homeoprophylaxis programs is 200C, which means it's gone through 200 stages of dilution and succussion. So obviously we're dealing with the energy of the substance, not the crude molecular substance itself. So that's what we call a Nozode. The genus epidemicus, we mean by that is that when there's an outbreak of any disease, let's say influenza, let's say the flu season hits in a particular year, after you've seen a number of cases of the flu, maybe say a dozen cases, there's one or two remedies which really stand out and which you find to be indicated in most of those cases. So that's called a genus epidemicus remedy. So the first homeoprophylaxis application that Dr. Hahnemann used was using the remedy belladonna, which is a very toxic herb in crude state, to treat scarlet fever. But he also found that belladonna was able to prevent scarlet fever if given in advance of exposure because it was similar. See, homeopathy works on the law of similars. not just for treatment, but also for prevention. This is something that even homeopaths are not taught in some colleges. The law of similars applies not just to treatment, but to prevention as well. So the genus epidemicus remedy is potentially valuable when you're sure what that remedy will be, but that of course requires a group of people to become unwell before you can work it out. The nosode is very useful because we know in advance what the common symptoms of the infectious disease are, and the nosode can be very, very useful in preventing those, even if before we have a number of cases on which to work out a genus epidemicus remedy.
Cheryl Mott in the chat heard you say 200C, and she says, do you always give 200C as a preventative, and how often would you give it?
Okay, so there's a difference between short-term prevention and long-term prevention. I also see people who are going overseas, and they come to me and ask me about things like typhoid, malaria, cholera, those sorts of diseases. So the protocol is different depending whether the prevention is just for a few weeks or a month or two, or long-term, which is the main program that I use in Australia. In a long-term program, just for a single disease, right, I give a single dose of 200. Then if there's no reaction, and usually there isn't, a month later I give a triple dose of 200, which is three doses in 24 hours. And then I don't give another dose for a year when I would give a triple dose of a 10M. But as I said, this is a little bit complicated to talk about over Skype. It's better if you can actually see the tables in front of you. And all of that is published. And actually, if people want to go onto my website, I do have some simple articles embedded there, one of which contains an outline of my program.
Why don't you tell us the name of your website? So it's
homestudy.net.
Okay.
So it's not home study. A lot of people put home study in.
Right.
It's homestudy, as in homeopathy study,
okay.
.net.
Okay, I put it on the chat for folks to look at. And we also, Dr. Sharma, did you have any comments or questions? And do you do any kind of homeoprophylaxis in the same way that Dr. Golden does?
Yes, I would like to share one thing, that the best example of homeoprophylaxis is the homeopath itself or the regular patients of using the homeopathy. Here in India, millions of the people are using homeopathy very regularly, and they are very less prone to the disease, like malaria, like typhoid, like measles or mumps, or like chickenpox. They never had a disease. And so the homeopaths or the patient who are using the homeopathy have a long life. So there is a good example of the homeoprophylaxis also.
Because a large percentage of the population in India visit to a homeopath rather than to an allopath?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So they have a less disease. They are less affected by the community medicine diseases like the cholera, like malaria, like typhoid. And I have a good example of my patient. He is using homeopathy since 15 years. And he never had any type of communicable disease in the last 15 years.
And it, obviously that would be in an area where other people were getting it.
Because
I haven't had anything in many years either, but I take homeopathic remedies. We have in the chat something that you already touched upon, Dr. Golden, which was taking a trip to the tropics and preventing malaria and cholera. Those folks who like to travel and are typically, they go to prevention for disease control and they check what is happening in the area and usually get a vaccine. What do you say to folks who ask you? And I also want to make sure that people know you're not doing it this yourself. You're going to see a professional to get your own personal advice.
Correct. And look, just a comment on what Dr. Sharma said. Unlike his experience in India, where homeopathy is part of mainstream medicine, in Australia, most of the people who come to me for, say, overseas travel remedies are not regular homeopathic users. And so they don't have the advantage of necessarily a really good diet or constitutional treatment over many years. And so it's important that they have something which actually targets the disease itself. Now, what I tell to people when they make inquiries about overseas travel is firstly go on the WHO website or government websites to see what's recommended. I also, though, say to them that if they can talk to someone in the area where they're going to try and find out exactly what is active, that's important because, you know, sometimes people will come to me with a list of 12 diseases and the first thing I say is, let's reduce the list. And I don't make recommendations personally about what diseases people should cover because I can't keep up to date with what's active in every part of the world. It's their responsibility. But I always try and get them to minimize the list to what is really needed. So for your listeners there, I think that's important as a first step. You don't want to be taking remedies for 12 different diseases when only two or three may be necessary. Then the next thing I find out from them is when they're going and how long they're going for, because that makes a difference to the program. I always try and get in a couple of doses of the indicated medicine before they leave. So I like people to start about a month before they leave, if possible. I try and, as I say, get a couple of doses of the indicated remedy in for each individual disease, and usually I recommend a fortnightly dose whilst they're away. Now, that will totally depend on the individual circumstances of where they're going and the likelihood of a high level of exposure. If they're going into an area where there is an extremely high level of exposure, I would recommend doses more frequently. And the opposite, if they're going to an area when there's very, very little likelihood of exposure, less frequently. Because experience tells us, both with vaccines and with homeoprophylaxis, that the failures that do occur, and there always are failures, the failures that do occur are generally when there is a consistent level of exposure. So, for example, with whooping cough, very often children who get whooping cough, it's passed on from parents who bring it home. They don't know they've got the disease. They've just maybe got a mild, irritating tickle in the throat or a mild cough. But the child is then constantly exposed on a daily basis. So it's a simile with your travelling. If you're going to an area where there is a high level of exposure, you need to take the remedy more often. So I would tend to tailor each program according to the actual need of the person. If they're going for 6 months or a year, I would give probably a slightly higher potency and give it less frequently, with the proviso that if they happen to go to an area where there's high levels of exposure, they just up it for a few weeks whilst they're there.
My question to you is, one, do you take people's cases from Skype or overseas or telephone or email for people who would be interested in getting more knowledge from you, besides going to your website and looking at your books and downloading them and studying themselves? They probably would want somebody who has experience. And let me ask you that one first.
Well, you've asked a slightly different question, and that is, do I take people's cases? And generally the answer is no.
Okay.
But if you mean, do I give advice about homeopathic immunization or prepare simple programs for people at a distance, the answer is yes, although I wouldn't do it internationally because, particularly in America, there are plenty of good homeopaths in America and Canada who would be quite competent to actually do this. I have a colleague in America, for example, who handles my long-term prophylaxis program against the six diseases that I mentioned. So whenever I get an inquiry from America, I just refer it to my colleague there. But in terms of overseas travel, it's actually not as complicated as it might be in taking a case for treatment. As Kent himself said, prevention is much easier than treatment, because what we're preventing are the common symptoms of the particular targeted diseases, and we know what they are in advance. Whereas when we're treating a person, you have to take into account all of the individual reactions that the person has produced through symptoms to whatever miasm or whatever stressor has caused them to become unwell. So we need to differentiate those two things, Debbie. They are different.
Thank you. Also, do you have kits or specific remedy kits that you would say, if they're going overseas, to have on hand for emergencies, like Montezuma's Revenge or something like that?
Yes. Well, I mean, actually, one of my daughters, who is an experienced remedial therapist and is now formally studying homeopathy, she's been running my clinic for 3 years, and she's actually just designed her own, with my help, of course, her own first aid kits for local use as well as for overseas travel use. And so it would include things like Leadum for anti-tetanus. We use the Giardia nosode as a very useful general preventative as well as treatment for a lot of gastrointestinal upsets. People can also use remedies like Arsenicum album, Nux vomica, for those sort of gastrointestinal things as well. So, yes, we've put together a little kit. In terms of the long-term preventative program, I have a six-year program which I give to parents. And as I said, when I get inquiries from America, I refer them by email. I refer them to my colleague over there who does that. But other homeopaths in America, I'm sure, are doing similar work. Not everyone would, but some would be. But with first aid, we do things like that and make recommendations.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more to clarify about the six-year program, because this is a new concept to me.
Right, and it's a new concept to many homeopaths. And as I said, some homeopaths, when I first started doing this, and you know, I've been doing this for almost 30 years, so I've copped a lot of criticism from both orthodox but also homeopathic circles. There are some homeopaths who believe we should only ever treat disease, we should never try and prevent it, but I just refer them back to Hahnemann. But anyway, that's another story. In terms of the long-term program, I know that there are many homeopaths who are not familiar with that. So what I basically started doing, this was back in 1985 when I developed my first homeoprophylaxis kit. The aim of that was to give parents who had chosen not to vaccinate an option which would cover the major diseases in the orthodox vaccination program. Now, I've changed that program three times since then. Not major changes, but there were some changes in potencies and some changes in the diseases. And in fact, I took out some of the milder diseases to put in some of the more serious ones like meningococcal disease and pneumococcal disease back in 2004. So what this program does, it starts from 1 month of age. It gives a dose of medicine once a month. And I explained briefly before the protocol, a single, then a triple of one particular remedy, and then a month later a single, and then a month later a triple of a different remedy. So over the first 12 months, we cover the six diseases I mentioned. Then there are bigger gaps in the program, going to every second, every third, and every fourth month using the higher potencies. And then I just use triple doses of the higher potencies of the targeted diseases over 6 years. So by the time they get to the end of the program, they're giving a dose of a different medicine about every 4 months. So it's not a high level of dosing at all.
Well, I know that meningitis for college students is a problem. Are there other, are you training homeopaths to do this program, or that was
look I actually have for many years in Australia and also in some countries overseas, including Canada, just recently, which I popped up to when I was visiting Cuba. I actually have a one-day seminar where I train homeopaths in using homeoprophylaxis, both long-term and short-term. Because I've been writing a lot of material in Australia for many, many years, you know, for decades, most Australian homeopaths are familiar with my work, and I've given many seminars over the last couple of decades to different practitioners around Australia. So the level of knowledge of this type of approach is very high here. One day, if I'm ever invited, I'll come to America and be very happy to do the same there. I don't know if doing it by Skype would be quite the same as doing it face-to-face, because it is quite technical. The one-day seminar with practitioners is, you know, pretty full-on and would probably be difficult at a distance. But, I mean, nothing's impossible with technology these days, I guess.
Yeah, so a lot of long-distance education is going on. Dr. Sharma, did you have any comments or questions?
One of the Barbary is asking about the doses of the potency and when we use in the traveling. So I am just reading the questions. And Dr. Sharma, how long before leaving do you start the treatment as a home prophylaxis in the traveling while a patient is traveling? And I just answered that we are using the potency 200 in general as a home prophylaxis, and almost one day before or a few hours before he or she traveling.
Yes, look, I prefer that people start taking remedies a month before they leave. And the reason for that is that that allows a person to get two doses of the necessary medicine. This is for each individual disease. Before they leave, because I give the doses a fortnight apart. And I generally use 200, sometimes an M for overseas travel. The 10 M I generally only use for long-term prophylaxis, and that's only because it gives a much longer length of prevention.
Is your protocol anything like Tynus-Smith's?
Tynus-Smith's was more to do with vaccine damage. Okay. The treatment of vaccine damage, which I'm happy to talk about because that's my own personal clinic. I think probably half of my patients these days are autistic children, many of whom, most of whom have been vaccine damaged. So I'm not aware of Tynus's protocol for prevention, but certainly for treatment. He and I communicated before his passing some years ago on a number of occasions, and the data that the two of us collected on that, and I actually published in one of my books, Vaccine Damaged Children, back in 2010, is very similar to his experience. Yeah, and my protocols are not the same. I do it individually for patients, but we follow a very similar approach.
Amnon tells you that you're radiating energy right now with the sun reflecting off of you. So it's like you're the moon and the sun all put together there.
I'll try and change. This is a very high window and the sun is moving and slightly, I'm going to be even more lit up soon.
Well, you're looking good.
You're going to be all tanned before the interview is over.
It's like driving,
is it okay?
Driving down the highway with your arm out in the sun. So,
well, I hope it's because God is favoring what I'm saying.
It is. The light is shining. Okay, so let's see. We have, how long would it last in malaria or cholera area? I think you started to respond to that they would continue in if they were in the endemic area for a long time.
Yes, if you're traveling to an area where there is, say, cholera or malaria, particularly malaria, then if there is constant exposure, you need to take, according to my protocol, a dose twice a week. Twice a month. In other words, a fortnightly dose. I mean, if there was incredibly extreme exposure that you knew, you could take it more often than that. And that's being overcautious, probably. But, you know, it's better to do that than to contract the disease itself. Now, if you were going to live in a malaria-prone area for months or years, a different protocol would be needed. I don't think it would be a good idea to be taking the indicated medicines weekly or fortnightly for years. I don't like that. I would prefer to use higher potencies and space out the doses. So it is an individual thing, but for most travellers, from most Australians who travel, they're going to be in areas for maybe up to a month or so, and a fortnightly or even a weekly dose if there's high exposure is not a problem.
We have so much to ask. Someone, Law Papa, he asked something a moment ago. Let's see what it was, if I can find. It was something about puncture wound, I think, tetanus.
Leadum for tetanus.
Is that it? Where did he go? There it is. Homeoprophylaxis for tetanus.
If it was leadum.
Okay.
Okay, so I have two approaches to that. In my main program, I do have the tetanus nozo, but I always recommend that if someone has a puncture wound, that they back that up with 3 doses a day for 3 days of leadum 30. That's a very well-tested tetanus treatment remedy. But if you get it in as soon as there's a wound, it actually is effective prophylaxis as well. That's what I personally use. I mean, I live in a rural area and occasionally step on a rusty nail in a horse paddock or something like that, or puncture myself on a barbed wire fence, and I just use the leadum for 3 days. So that was the remedy I was talking about with tetanus. By the way, I tried to move a little bit. Is that better from the light point of view?
Yes, you're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Sharma, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yes. Dr. Ishak, are you working on the homeoprophylaxis for the AIDS?
AIDS.
No. And I say that for legal reasons. As well as homeopathic reasons. But the question that I would ask is, what is AIDS anyway?
Good question.
What are you trying to prevent? So the answer is, I always give there is no.
Okay. And I was thinking, I'm going to kind of backtrack to something you said earlier in the conversation, and that was that allopathically, we're told to give up to 60 vaccinations to these children, and you were mentioning how, like the whooping cough, now has mutated to a form which the vaccines are not even effective. Do you want to comment on just on our man-made manufactured disease?
Look, I'd really love to talk about this point because this is one of the things that the Cubans have found. Now, when they first did their massive homeoprophylaxis against leptospirosis, they actually have a vaccine against leptospirosis, which is quite unique in the world, but it's about an 80% effectiveness. But the trouble is, if the strain changes, they have to change the vaccine. That takes months, and very often a new vaccine to a new strain may take 6 to 12 months if they rush it. One of the huge advantages homeopathy has to offer on the prophylaxis side of it is, firstly, homeoprophylaxis is not strain-specific. Homeoprophylaxis works on the law of similars. So provided the symptoms that are produced by a particular strain, let's say of whooping cough, are similar to the symptoms that are produced by a different strain of whooping cough, and by the way, they usually are, then you can still use the same prophylaxis remedy. But even if you needed to develop a different nozode, that can be done very quickly. The Cubans actually produced their first homeoprophylaxis against leptospirosis in 2 weeks, and that was for 2.2 million people. And they, within 3 weeks, they had produced and distributed the prophylaxis, the first dose, to 2.2 million people. They used, by the way, a 200C potency, and they repeated that about a week or 10 days later. So in infectious disease control, both for endemic as well as epidemic diseases, homeopathy has a huge amount to offer, more than orthodox medicine can ever realize until they actually legitimately look at this. And I, you know, God willing, one day they will, because it has the potential to save immense suffering in the world.
Well, they must hear this message. They've got to listen and tune in, and we're responsible. we as listeners, we need to tell, go out and tell one person, go out and tell 10 people, and let those people tell other people, and talk to your doctors, and talk to, just blog about it, tweet about it, do anything, because this is the way we're going to get the message out that homeopathy has potential as preventative for these types of diseases and for curing, right? For getting people back to wholeness and to wellness much quicker than if they were using just regular drugs.
Yeah, I mean, look, the important point to me is that the best system of medicine is where patients have access to the best of both orthodox medicine and the best of complementary medicine, including, of course, homeopathy. And that was one of the wonderful things that I found in Cuba. Their medical system there, because, to be honest with you, that they've been under the American embargo for 50 years, the large pharmaceutical companies are not able to trade there, and therefore they've had to become totally self-sufficient in treatment as well as prevention. The doctors there are freely able, in the hospitals as well as in their own clinics, to use any form of medicine which will help the patient. And as a consequence of that, we find that the best of orthodox medicine is used alongside the best of complementary medicine. And it's just wonderful to see that. Now, in Australia, for example, we have a few clinics run by open-minded doctors where they work side by side with complementary medicine practitioners, including homeopaths. And I'm sure the same applies in America. But, I mean, in so-called developed Western countries, this needs to happen much more frequently. And it will happen once the politicians put the patient concerns at the top of their list, and once orthodox medical practitioners are given encouragement to do exactly the same, and once their education is not so tied to the massive funding that comes from the drug companies, then they'll be encouraged to give their patients what they feel is the very best for the patient, not just what they've been told to do by, you know, people who promote certain products. Sorry, I'm getting off track.
No, that was perfectly good answer, on track. Do you want to say anything else? Because we have 1 minute, 2 minutes? How many minutes do we have?
We're over already, but go ahead.
Oh, we are? Okay. I want to give you an opportunity just
time
to...
Flies,
yeah, we're having a great time here. And besides all of the thank yous that I want to give, I want to give you an opportunity to just say whatever it is that you want to end the show with.
Right. But what I'd like to end the show with is that I have enormous respect for parents who are prepared to be courageous enough to make decisions independent of orthodox advice. That doesn't mean to ignore orthodox advice, but to include that advice alongside the best information that they can gain from other sources, and then act on that. I know in Australia, and it's probably the same here, the parents who choose not to vaccinate are often pilloried as being ignorant and uninformed and putting the rest of the community at risk. That is a lie. In fact, these are the parents who are helping the community more than anyone can realize. So more strength for them. They're the reason I do what I do. And I, God willing, I hope that the information that I've been able to prepare will assist those people. And, you know, if I'm very, very happy to extend the conversation another date if you'd like to.
We will definitely have you back. And folks out there, if you have questions, send them in to me, homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com. Go to Dr. Golden's website. Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.